Hey y'all, and welcome to today's episode. In today's episode, I talked to John Fahield, the Chair of Entrepreneurship at Duke Fakhri's School of Business. From December 2000 until July 2004, John served as Vice President of Engineering for Align Technology in Santa Clara. Between 1995 and 2000, he served as CEO of two RTP venture-backed firms, Geomagic, a 3D software company, and NetEdge Systems, a data networking equipment company. Prior to that, John spent 13 years at IMB, where he served in a number of management and executive positions within the networking and software business units. He began his professional career as an assistant professor in the philosophy department at Duke University and is now the chair of entrepreneurship at Duke Fakhri School of Business. John has a PhD and an MBA from Duke University. And without further ado, let's just get started. John, thank you for joining and welcome to the podcast. So, first off, I kind of want to start by asking, how did you get into entrepreneurship? And if you could please share your story on becoming a professor at Duke.
Logan, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to speak with you and to connect with all of the people listening to the podcast. Let me start by a little plug for Duke, great university. A lot of kids from the West Coast come east to Duke University, and I hope many of you consider it. Like so many things in my career, I would say it was somewhat accidental how I got into entrepreneurship. Unlike all of you, I never heard of entrepreneurship when I was in high school or in college. I studied philosophy and math in college, got a PhD in philosophy. My first job was actually teaching at Duke in the late 70s. But I realized that that was probably not going to be a long-term career for me. Academia was not the best place. And so I got a master's in computer science to prepare myself to get out into the business world. If you can imagine, in the late 70s, computers were starting to become something significant. So what we would now say, I made that pivot. I was very fortunate in getting a job at IBM in 1982. I worked there for 13 years. I realized about halfway through that part of my career that I wasn't cut out to be in a big company. I was much more interested in small teams, working together, working hard to get things done rather than large organizations arguing about what we should do. So I made the shift and joined the startup as VP of marketing in the mid-90s. I became CEO of that company, sold that, became CEO of another startup that was a software company, which we eventually sold, became the VP of engineering at another startup called Align Technology. That's now actually quite a big company that we made clear plastic devices that straighten your teeth called Invisalign, went public in 2001. That was a great ride, most successful startup I've ever been involved in. And but living in North Carolina, working in Santa Clara was becoming a bit of a strain on my family. And I left in 2004, took a year off, was asked to teach a couple of courses at Duke. I did that. I didn't have any intention of staying there, but it became very attractive, and here I am 15 years later. So I think that, forgive me for, you know, what's a fairly long story, but when you're my age, a lot's happened. And I think the thing that I've learned is, I would say many of the twists and turns in my career were not necessarily planned, but I was open to the opportunity, and I took advantage of it. And so I am now a professor, and I've been a professor at Duke, also the director of the Innovation and Entrepreneurship Initiative at Duke University. I've been extremely fortunate, very happy throughout my career, but you could hardly look at my career and say this was all planned out.
Great. So, you know, jumping into our discussion about, you know, the fundamentals of entrepreneurship, so many people have their own definition of entrepreneurship. So I was wondering if you could kind of go into more depth of what is entrepreneurship in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, and of course, a term that is so popular and is used by so many people in so many contexts, of course, it has different meanings for different people. For me, the essence of entrepreneurship is finding an opportunity, creating a novel solution, and making it happen. So the opportunity is generally a need or a problem that some set of people have that you have uniquely identified. Then the creativity comes to in the creation of a novel, compelling solution, and those two are critical components, but it's the actual discipline, perseverance to get it done and affect the change through a startup or through some other form of change. But I think those three elements, being a very careful observer so you can see needs, problems that other people don't see, the creativity to come up with a novel, compelling solution, and then the discipline to execute and make it happen. To me, that's the essence of entrepreneurship.
Great. So, you know, obviously when any entrepreneur that's starting their own startup company, they face so many challenges, and they have to have these attributes, these skills, these motives to succeed. So do you mind talking, what do you think are the attributes of a successful entrepreneur?
Yeah, happy to do that, Logan. And I think my definition of entrepreneurship doesn't make it a solo sport. In fact, I think entrepreneurship is a team sport. So I think that everyone has some capacity to be involved in a successful entrepreneurial team. I think the things that I talked about are important, but so an entrepreneurial team will not be successful if they haven't found a valuable opportunity, created a compelling solution, and then pulled together to make it happen. The role that an individual plays in that effort can vary widely. Not everybody has to be the idea person. In fact, coming up with the idea is, you know, 0.01% of the journey. So I think that there are some things that I think are important. Humility, number one, so that you're open and can listen and think critically about your idea as opposed to thinking you're smarter than everybody. The courage to do something different and unique. The perseverance, the capacity to not to be knocked down by things that come up. These are all important, but I think what is really critical for young people considering this career is not the question of whether am I a complete entrepreneur, but the question is, what are my strengths and what are the areas that I am not strong, and how can I become part of a team that can effectively bring about a change that is the basis of a successful venture? So, you know, those attributes I talked about are critical, but I would say even more critical is to be thoughtful about yourself and recognize you're good at some things, you're not so good at other things, so find people who complement you and try to become part of a team that will be a high-functioning team.
Great. You talked a lot about, you know, what can you bring to the table, specifically your product or service. So do you mind going into kind of more about that? Do you mean when you have to differentiate yourself from like the rest of the brands or the rest of the services that are similar to you? Or do you mean making a completely different product or service that is different from everyone else? Do you mind going into that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd be happy to chat about that. So being different is not necessarily valuable. Being better for the customer is what's valuable. I find too many people worried about being different as opposed to worrying about being good and valuable for the customer. Let me just step back a little bit and say one of the things that I think prevents most young entrepreneurs and old entrepreneurs for being successful is they fall in love with their product idea, and then they start seeing the customer through the lens of their product. And I think that's the most important thing. The most important thing is actually the customer and solving a problem, addressing a need. And if you're 100% focused on how can I create the best possible solution for my customer, as opposed to being obsessed with technology or a system you designed or an app or a device or whatever, you have a much better chance of succeeding. And I think too many entrepreneurs that I see are in love with their technology and they've forgotten about the customer. And that's almost always a recipe for failure.
So in your opinion, you believe that for any entrepreneur, any startup company, they should be, in touch with their customers more often to see what needs they might have or what needs they want to be fulfilled?
Yeah, if you want to be obsessed about anything, be obsessed about solving a problem for a customer. And don't be obsessed with what you built or what cool software or device you designed.
Cool. So, that kind of goes into kind of how startups fail. So I was wondering if you could kind of give a brief background of some startups that you've seen fail and what kind of they've done and what do you think they could have done better and, why these startup companies failed?
There are many ways to fail. The one that I see most often, and this is not surprising, but the one that I see so often is the thing that I just mentioned. It's what venture capitalists refer to as a solution looking for a problem. When you have a solution looking for a problem, you're in deep trouble. When you have a problem looking for a solution, you might have something. I would say that's the most common source of failure. And I think that it's not surprising because you're operating in unknowns and you can never be sure at the beginning. So you shouldn't beat yourself up if, in fact, what you thought was a need was not a real need out there. But the quicker you find that out and move on to something else, the better off you're going to be. But if you found a real problem, then you still have to execute. You have to build the right product. It has to have quality. It has to satisfy the needs of the customer. You have to be able to get customers efficiently, effectively. You have to charge them the right price. I mean, there are so many elements of executing on the idea that if you mess some of the critical things up, you are not going to succeed. And that is very hard work, takes persistence, takes some amount of experience and knowledge. But I think that I'll leave it there.
Great. So do you mind going into, how do entrepreneurs and companies raise money/capital for their business?
Yeah, so raising money, bringing capital into an enterprise so that you can actually build the venture, that money generally comes from investors. Investors in startups are people who are willing to make risky bets because they think that some of them will pay off big. So I might invest, let's just to pick round numbers, $100,000 in 10 companies, and if two of them return 10 times their money and all of the others fail, I have still made good money on my investments. And that's the kind of investments that venture capitalists make. What they're looking for, this is venture capital. This is not the only kind of investing, but venture capital is looking for new companies that have the potential to grow to be large and valuable companies. Sometimes, to take Amazon as an example, Amazon went over 10 years before they ever made any profit, but they became a very, very valuable company as measured by the stock price. That's what venture capitalists are looking for. They're looking for you to build a large, valuable company. That often goes with profit, but those are not the same thing.
Great. Do you mind also going into, Can you explain how stock options and, equity compensation works in a startup company?
So suppose, Logan, you and I start a company and we decide to be 50-50 partners. And let's say we just create 1 million shares and we each have 500,000 shares. That's equity. We are now 100% owners of this company. We each own 500,000 shares. Suppose we decide we need $1 million invested in the company for us to achieve our first set of milestones and start to build the venture. We can, if we're successful in convincing an investor, we might convince them to give the business $1 million at, let's say, $1 a share. So they have valued our company at $1 million. They give us an additional $1 million. And we give them 1 million shares. Now, there used to be 1 million shares. We each had 500,000. Now there are 2 million shares. And the investors own 1 million. So we now still have the same number of shares. Before that transaction, we had 50% of the company. After, we now have 25% of the company each. And this is the concept known as dilution. As you issue more shares to bring in capital, the percentage ownership represented by a number of shares becomes less. That's what equity is. And founders' equity or other employees' equity is their stake, their ownership in the company. Stock options are a mechanism that startups use to, like, if you were to hire me, you're the founder of the company, you want me to join, let's say, as the vice president of marketing, you might say, we will give you 100,000 shares in options that vest over 4 years. The option, what is known as the strike price, is the price that I would have to pay to buy that share. Let's say it's a dollar. So I have 100,000 options that vest over 4 years. I work hard for 4 years, and now I can buy 100,000 shares of the company for $100,000. If I'm very fortunate, the stock that used to be worth a dollar is now worth $10, and so I can buy it for 100,000 and sell it for 1 million. And so options are a future opportunity to buy shares at a fixed price. And that's how stock option compensation works. You know, you hire me, it's 100,000 shares, and it vests over 4 years. So incrementally over that 4 year period, my right to purchase shares increases up to that $100,000 maximum.
But I was also kind of wondering, so stock options, right? You would think of Facebook, right? They would give stock options to their workers, their employees for, let's say, a few shares in Facebook stock, right? Is that kind of how it works also?
Yeah. Well, so I you know, different companies, you know, when I worked at IBM, which is a company that was, you know, close to 100 years old, I had stock options, but the stock option is always fixed. You know, the law is the price of an option has to be fixed at the current market value of that stock. So for a publicly traded company, legally, you have to offer the option at the current stock price. And then you, the employee, hopes that the stock becomes more valuable so you can still buy it at a low price and sell at a high price. I don't know, you know, once companies become public, they usually restrict the number of employees that they offer options to. When something is a startup, they offer options to everybody because they often can't pay as high a salary. So it's another form of compensation. So Facebook, I'm sure Facebook offers options to some. I'd be very surprised if all new employees to Facebook get stock options.
Yeah. That brings me to my next question. You know, is every startup company's goal to be bought out by another company, such as, you know, Apple buying Beats headphones, which is also known as a sales trade, or do they always want to try and go public, right, which is also called an IPO? which is an initial public offering.
Yeah, some companies know that they're, so what you're referring to is the event that in this world is called the exit. The exit is the opportunity for investors to sell their shares. There are two forms of exit. One is acquisition by another company. The other is an initial public offering so that there's a public market for the shares. So the purpose is for the investors to be able to sell their stock. That's why it's called an exit. If you and I start a biotechnology company, we are almost certainly going to exit through an acquisition because it's extremely difficult to raise enough capital to take a product to market in that space. If you and I start an app company, the logical exit is probably also a sale because there's usually not enough critical mass for an app company to be a public company. You can't get to the scale, et cetera. So our expectation is a bit determined by the market. However, if we have a unique enterprise kind of software, so a Duke grad about 6 years ago started the company Airtable. I don't know if you're familiar with Airtable, but they went public because they had a unique solution that was scalable and could reach corporate customers, and they could really build an independent business. And their goal was to go public. Invisalign, that I mentioned, you know, when we were at Align, our strategy was always an IPO. It was always to go public because there were no logical buyers, and we thought that this could be an independent company and could grow to be a very large independent company. So sometimes you can tell in advance based on the market you're in, the kind of market, whether you could be successful as an independent company or would really need to be part of a larger corporation to grow. Sometimes you're not sure, and you sort of, that strategy evolves as your company grows.
Yeah. You know, I feel like this is a pretty important topic, especially when it comes to entrepreneurship, right? Let's say they do go IPO, they go public. Could you talk a little bit, right, about, there's so much risk, especially when you're starting a venture, right? And then especially when it goes public, there has to be, you know, initial demand, but also demand needs to keep growing over time. As we know, the future is uncertain. So can you discuss what challenges an entrepreneur might face when he is trying to, you know, develop his idea further and then sell that service to customers once it does go public, you know, such as demand risk, execution risk, financing risk?
Yeah, well, so those risks, especially the financing risk, is a relatively early issue. The demand risk, when investors talk about market risk or demand risk, what they're talking about is the question of whether there really is a market for the company's product. By the time you're ready to go public, you've already proven that there's a market. Now the question is, can you grow enough? Can your share be large enough? Can you find other markets, et cetera, to continue on a growth trajectory? So there are many risks, but there are risks for every company. And in fact, if you look at who's in the S&P 500 now compared to 20 years ago, or you know, maybe longer, very few companies remain successful for a very long time. You know, I heard the other day that the company Zoom is now more valuable than General Motors and Ford. You know, it's kind of mind-boggling. Let me give you. Do you know the name Netscape?
Yeah. Yes.
You remember Netscape? So Netscape went public in 1995. They were the biggest, kind of the hottest company in 1995. They lasted for about 5 minutes, because. What, you know, they eventually got sold to AOL, and you know, whether the Netscape browser is anywhere now, who knows. But what they They had a great market, but they had no sustainable competitive advantage in this market. And as soon as Microsoft decided that a browser was a really nice feature to have in Windows, Netscape was dead. The market risk, the early execution risk, the financing risk are all things that you face very early. But to become sustainable, you have to have a position. You have to have a set of unique, valuable capabilities and resources that other people cannot attack. I think once you get that far down in your planning, you need to be much more deliberate than some entrepreneurs are about what will constitute their sustainability long term. And by the way, if you come to the conclusion that maybe you don't have a sustainable competitive advantage that can last for a long time, you better exit through an acquisition because you're not going to make it as a public company.
Great. So just to reiterate what you said, right, the financing risk is kind of how you develop capital from investors, and if they're looking into a company, which is your company, that they think will be a good investment for them. And that's usually in the early stage of a venture. And then also the demand risk at times is varies from the early stage to the mid stage as well. But then you said that execution risk, right, that's just mostly assembling a good team, a good pretty much like foundation in order to succeed and go public or go through acquisition. Is that correct?
That's a good summary. That's a very good summary. Let me ask you a question. Do you think Facebook faces a market risk? See, it's interesting that you're not sure. Go ahead.
I feel like Facebook doesn't face that much of a market risk. Not only has their stock been so consistent in the last 10 years, but also, right, we think of different markets and what Facebook has done. Not that many people have done what Facebook has done, and there's so many other companies that are competing with them, obviously, but I mean, from what I've seen, their stock price has been pretty consistent, and also they have other competing brands, right? But they've been at the top, so that's what I kind of see.
So what do you think Facebook's product is?
So Facebook's product is similar to what I believe is Instagram. If you've heard of Instagram, I believe Facebook's kind of similar to Instagram.
Of course. Yeah, well, I think that Facebook's product is you, and their customer is the advertiser. And there is there are recent moves among advertisers that make them not quite so willing to buy the product. And there are some comparable moves among their product, namely users, that so if I were Facebook, I wouldn't panic, but I would wonder whether some of these recent moves among their user base and among their customers who are the advertisers, to wonder if there might be some chinks in what has been a very strong market position up to now. This is the kind of thing I'm talking about where, good entrepreneurs, good managers are constantly asking the tough questions and never sitting back, self-satisfied that things will go on forever. There are always changes lurking that might impact your business, and it's really important to recognize them early.
Yeah, but I also realize that Facebook has been so successful in the past few years, many years actually, but it's more because I just realized that they appeal to so many market segments, right? They appeal from young adults to adults in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, right? Compared to maybe Instagram, which is mostly focused on young teenagers, maybe kids in high school, college, and maybe in their early 20s. So that's why I feel like Facebook has also been successful and their stock price has been going up consistently for the last past 10 years. But that's, I just see it appeals to so many people.
Yeah, and the question is, will it continue to appeal? Will, the use of Facebook to undermine our political system, all of the negative effects, will what kind of effect will they have? Anyway, I'm not making a prediction about Facebook. I'm just, it's just an example of how even the most successful companies need to be vigilant continually if they're going to stay successful.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. But I know this is a little bit, we're jumping into between topics, but do you mind kind of explaining, I guess, in the, back to early stage, you know, creating a business plan? Could you explain what a business plan is and some of the components that make up a business plan, such as like an executive summary, cash flow, market strategy?
Let me start maybe where you're going next and say the most, we'll talk about a business plan document, which is something, you know, whether it's in PowerPoint, verbal, or in a, you know, fancy three-ring binder kind of a package. It's basically what entrepreneurs deliver to investors. What are the elements of it? Well, number one, you have to explain why the opportunity you are going after is a valid opportunity. You have to demonstrate that there's a real market and it's big enough. You have to demonstrate that your product is valued by those customers, is compelling for those customers. You have to demonstrate that you have a unique position that might be sustainable for the long term and justify the investment. So there's a set of things that say, here is why this opportunity is worth investing in. Then on the other side, you have to say, here is our plan to go after that opportunity and why you should believe in that plan. And that plan has a number of elements. And the first is an overall strategy where you have picked the right customer to begin, what some entrepreneurs refer to as the beachhead customer. You have a business model where you've defined a product and a revenue model, and you know how the customer is going to pay you, how you're going to get the customers for a reasonable price, etc. And then you have to talk about the kind of company you're going to build, what you're going to invest the investor's money in, and why that will create a sustainable venture. Those elements, explaining why the opportunity is worth investing in, and explaining your plan to go after it with those key elements covered, if that's compelling, investors will put money into it.
Great. I kind of want to learn more about, you know, the idea of a minimum viable product. I feel like that's not only important in the early stage, but also throughout, you know, the future, because they're still trying to develop new features, new ideas for the product in order for it to be, you know, successful, but also create higher demand in the future. So, you know, the product keeps on, you know, being successful instead of going through getting bought out or, you know, going out of business. So can you talk a little bit about what a minimum viable product is?
Well, I think, so a minimum viable product is not my favorite concept because I think it obscures what the key idea is. Let me give you an example. Do guys your age drink coffee?
Me personally, I don't, but others do, yes.
Do they go to Starbucks?
Yeah, that's a big one.
So Starbucks, if you go back to the beginning of Starbucks, Howard Schultz began with the hypothesis that people would spend a lot more money for a cup of coffee if it was a fancy cappuccino or high-quality coffee served in a very comfortable setting. This is before the days of drive-through and all the rest of the stuff. You know, it wasn't a takeout operation. So he started with that idea. Now, let me ask you a question. At that time, how would he know whether there was a market for this product? In other words, how would he know whether people actually would behave this way, pay this much money, drink coffee in his establishments? Could you go ask people? Could I say, hey, Logan, you know, I've got this idea for a cool new drink, and we're going to serve it in an establishment where you stand around with flashing lights. Would you do that?
At first, I would probably think no. Right? That idea is so out of the ordinary. right? But also at the same time, I'd be kind of intrigued to know a little bit more about the product or about what they're trying to do.
So you might try it, and if you liked it, you might come back. Okay, so now this is the situation that an entrepreneur is in. They have an idea that people will buy a product or buy a service or, adopt a new practice, but can they be sure in advance? No, right? That's the key, the core uncertainty in any new venture is, will people adopt a product that they probably haven't seen before? And if you ask them, the answer will generally be, I don't know. I would try it, and I might. And so how would you know whether there's an actual demand there? What you have to do is test it. You have to create the experiment to see whether there is the kind of adoption that you're hoping for, whether the product, whether you, Logan, as a consumer, find this product or this environment, this experience really compelling, and you want to keep coming back, and you want to, and the idea behind a minimum viable product is to create the test to see whether the demand is real. I have a hypothesis about the demand, but I don't know that it's there unless I test it. So the question then is, how do I test it? So in the case of Starbucks and Howard Schultz, he built a coffee shop in Seattle and ran it for a while to see what would happen. And once he had seen it there, at least he knew that there was some market. He didn't know whether the same thing would work in Malaysia and Siberia, but at least he knew it would work in those kinds of environments. So that's an example of this concept of a market test that a minimum viable product represents. We use the term minimum viable product because it came out of the Lean Startup, which is a kind of a tech-oriented way of thinking about startups. But if you think about startups more broadly, you always have this idea of how do I perform the market test that lets me understand whether my product idea is really valid and really maybe test parts of the need. Maybe I've got the coffee drink right, but I've got the ambiance wrong, or, because it's a bit of a complex value proposition. So I think it's critical to test your ideas and not go on faith. Not, and this is to go back to what I was saying before, people that fall in love with their product are often really bad at testing it because they're not open-minded. But if you're open-minded and you fall in love with your customer, then you're going to perform the test to find out what the customer really wants, and then you're going to build something that they will really find valuable.
Great. Kind of jumping into strategy, we often hear that a company needs to have a long-term strategy for their business that will not only keep high demand, but also allow the company to keep growing as a whole. So what could you kind of go into what is entrepreneurial strategy and how do such business strategies incorporated into a business plan or overall in a business help them succeed?
Yes, and that's a great question, and it's a really important question. And strategy is a really critical concept in business and certainly in entrepreneurship. Let me just start by saying some people say that in a startup, the most important thing is to start. I believe that. But I also believe that having a big vision is critical. So if you think about your concept of your new venture, you need to have a big vision of how you're really going to affect a big change and represent a big market. And you have to have an idea of what's my first step? What's something I can do to get started? Those are critical elements of a strategy. Now, in my framework, there are four key elements of strategy. One is choosing your customer, because regardless of your view of I'm eventually going to cover the whole world, your customers are not all the same. And you have to be very deliberate about what the different segments are and where you're going to start. So, critical step number one, first critical choice. Then you're going to decide, how am I going to serve this customer? What's the product? What else needs to exist? how am I going to reach the customer? How am I going to deliver it? How much am I going to charge? All of those things that I lump under the concept of business model. Second critical element of strategy. Third critical element is, what is the company we're going to build? What are we going to do inside? What are we going to be the best in the world at? And what will we form relationships or partnerships to do? Are we going to sell ourselves so that we have, you know, a top-notch sales organization in this space? Or are we going to sell through a distributor or through somebody else? Are we going to do the engineering ourselves? Are we going to let somebody else do that? What is it that's the core of our company? And that's where this notion of sustainable competitive advantage comes in. I need to define a core that can be sustainable once, because if we're successful in our view of the market and our product, people will start coming after us. And how, what's the moat we've built that protects our venture? Third critical element. And the fourth is this concept of a roadmap. What are the steps? What's the first step, the second step, the third step? How are we going to roll this out in a way that we can get started and then continue on this journey toward this big vision? Those are the four key elements of strategy as I think about it. And the important thing is, these are choices that need to be made explicitly. You can't just say, I'm a high school kid, I want to build an app that tests something or other, therefore my market is high school kids. You don't know until you think critically about who has this issue and where are the market niches that you might go after. These are all choices that define the rails that your venture is going to run on.
So do you believe strategy in a venture is very undervalued compared to anything else?
I think that people don't have as clear a notion of what they are doing in strategy. So there's an expression that goes back decades and decades that relies on the distinction between what is urgent and what is important. When you're in a startup, if you're the CEO of a startup, there are fires burning every day that are demanding your attention. They are not always important. And being able to sort through all of the stuff, all of the noise, and focus on what is critical, that is vital to success. And you have to have the clarity of a strategy if you're going to be successful at that. If you don't, you're going to bounce around from one crisis to the next, and then you're going to look back over the last 6 months and realize you worked your tail off 16 hours a day, and you didn't really accomplish anything. So I think clarity on strategy and using strategy to focus and be able to define what's really important for success, that's essential.
So I'm kind of curious about, is there a difference between short-term strategy and long-term strategy? Is long-term strategy kind of like, once you do go public, you're trying to, you know, make sure that you have a long-term strategy and like everything goes well? And then is like short-term strategy when you're just trying to get like bought out?
I would say no. The key decisions are the same. And basically, whether you're going to go public or be acquired, you're trying to build a venture that has value. And you have to ask yourself, what are the things that build value? And those are the key decisions that I talked about. Focus on a customer that is willing to accept your solution, having a reasonable business model, having the sustainable core of capabilities. Those are the things that will be attractive to the public market or to an acquirer. So I think no. I think that obviously there are some differences in degree whether you're thinking 5 years out versus 1 year out, but the kinds of decisions you're making are basically the same.
Great. I feel like this topic is often misinterpreted by young entrepreneurs while it goes back to kind of risk. And especially when they're trying to create initial demand for the product, I feel like entrepreneurship is so applicable to young people who want to start their own businesses. So do you mind kind of going into what are performance gaps and opportunity gaps and how they can kind of help a business adjust what they're doing or, find what they need to improve on for their company?
so I don't want to generalize, but here's something I see quite often, especially with younger tech-oriented entrepreneurs. They would rather sit in front of their computer and design something or write code than get out and interact with other people and talk to customers and really understand deeply what they want. You know, writing software is important, but building the wrong product is just a waste of your time. So in order to minimize the risk, really understand the demand and build something that will be compelling, you have to have a deep understanding of what your customers need. And you can only do that by interacting directly with them, going out and talking to them, calling people, talking to people you don't know, asking them questions, learning about them, learning about what they care about, etc. That's not easy for most, especially young people, to do. And so what they do instead is focus on designing software. And that's exactly the wrong thing to do. I use the example sometimes, I don't know if you know the company Estee Lauder, it's a cosmetics company. Estee Lauder was started by a young woman who, even as a teenager, was cooking stuff up in her kitchen. And as soon as she'd cooked up some new concoction, she went out on the street corners and she just asked random people, hey, can I try this on you? Can you tell me if you like this? That's what people need to do.
Great. So kind of jumping to our listeners' questions, we're obviously in quarantine and, you know, COVID-19 has affected the economy and the stock market so much. Do you mind kind of explaining from what you've kind of seen, but also what's your opinion of this? How has COVID-19 affected entrepreneurs, especially startups, and kind of what risk are they facing at the moment?
Well, you know, so if you've started a company that requires person-to-person interaction, you're facing a very significant risk right now. If you started a company that is for people who are generally out in public, you're also facing quite a bit of risk. So I heard that, you know, recently cosmetic sales are way down, chocolate sales are way up. So, you need to figure out how pivot your strategy to reflect the changing environment of your customers. If you can't do that, I mean, if your startup idea was a restaurant that involved a really cozy space, you just better hope you can hang on for a while. But there are many companies that have recognized what was happening and pivoted their services to reflect the environment of their customers. You know, obviously things that might have been in-person events becoming online events, to the extent you can do that successfully. You know, I mean, this is all obvious. This is why Zoom is now so valuable and General Motors isn't. But, it varies case by case. You said how much the stock market, the shocking thing about this is that the stock market has not moved, really. I mean, it dipped and has come back, and, you know, so, many people are wondering why there hasn't been more of an effect. But in terms of entrepreneurs, where your existence is much more fragile, you have to adapt to this changed environment, and if you can't do that, you will not survive. I mean, it's that simple. We have the Duke Angel Network that has 37 companies in its portfolio, all very early stage startups. Most of them have been able to adjust their strategy to deal with this environment. So in general, my limited experience, many startups are able to adjust.
Great. Last question. So this is a big question that, you know, a lot of my friends ask, but also, you know, just people that, you know, want to start their own little company, maybe in high school or in college. So what does it take to be a successful entrepreneur in today's world? even if you, let's say, taking consideration COVID, but also just in general?
I think that, we've talked about some of those things. COVID represents a dramatic change in the environment. And one of the things to recognize is opportunities are often occur when there is a big change. And so I don't know specifically what the answers are, but thinking about what has changed because of COVID-19, not just what's changed for these months where we're all quarantining basically, but I mean there are going to be long-term changes in business, in education, in many areas as a consequence of the fact that we've lived through this pandemic. And so what are those changes for the future, and what are the opportunities that are opened up by that long-term change? That I think, any if you want to start a company now, that's a very good question to be asking yourself. If you want to, and the obvious answers are probably going to be obvious to everybody. The successful entrepreneurs will come up with some answers that aren't obvious to everybody, but really are compelling. So, if you and a few of your friends want to talk about, what are the opportunities that we should think about? Spending some time talking about how the world is going to be different 2 years from now and how it will stay that way. That's what I would do.
Great. Well, I think that concludes the podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you learned something from this episode. Stay safe and take care.